Session number 27075, Reel 7.
Noodle Leggett, Reel 7.
As here on the 8th of July, I did a cross country from Montrose to Huntley to Kinloss, up to the north coast to Lossiemouth, back down to Huntley, and back to Montrose. That was a solo navigation exercise. Which lasted 2 hours, 45 minutes.
How do you navigate across country in an aircraft?
How
do you do that? How would you navigate across country?
Your basic piece of equipment is a map, bearing in mind we did not have radios in Masters. So you'd have a map to the appropriate scale, and before the flight, when we settled down in the crew room with the map and a ruler and some pencils and what is called a CSC, a course and speed calculator. So one obtains from the Met Department the expected wind in that area. Then one sets out, feeds in into the CSC, the wind speed, the distance, the track you wish the aircraft to make across the ground. And this little instrument will then give you a course to steer and the ground speed, which you will obtain with that particular setup. You then go out to the aircraft and do the flight, take off, turn round over the airfield, go across the centre of the airfield at the prescribed height, usually 1500 feet, and set off on the first leg, steering a compass course that you'd worked out from the information on the CSC. As one progressed across the country, one read the map the whole way, and the first instance one had where the aircraft was creeping off the required track, you then make a correction by adding or minusing a few degrees to bring the aircraft back onto its correct track. You arrive at the first turning point. You can then check on the time it took to cross to cover that country. And again, if you're over or undershooting, you can then make another correction to bring you back to the correct time. And so that's the procedure one would follow in this case, a flight with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4 legs.
Would you use visual sightings on the ground?
Oh yes, very much so. In fact, as part of the pre-flight preparation, it was advisable to highlight certain features that you would be easily identified from the air, enabling you to make early corrections. You know, so obviously, if it's necessary to make a correction to the course you're steering, the sooner you make that correction, the less likelihood there is that you'll stray too far from the required track. And it's always a lot easier to pick out features if you know you're on the required track than if you think you're off track, but you're not too sure which direction you've strayed from the required track.
Were there restrictions placed on you in these early training stages with cross-country navigation as to the weather and conditions, flying conditions?
Well, the authorizing officer would obtain the Met forecast before the flying program started, and it would be up to him to decide whether the conditions were suitable for any particular flight. Bearing in mind that this, although it's an advanced school, we're still inexperienced pilots, and therefore an important part of the authorizing officer's duty is to make quite sure that weather is suitable for that particular flight. I do recall that I think it was on this one I've just mentioned up to Lossiemouth. To get there from Montrose, one had to cross the Cairngorms, and the cloud base was just above the top of the peak I was going to have to cross. Now, if the conditions when I got there were such that the cloud was down on top of that mountain, the obvious thing for me, an inexperienced pilot, would be to about turn and go back to Montrose and report the fact that the cloud was below the standard expected, and then a decision would be taken whether to continue that exercise that day or not.
I would imagine the weather was quite changeable in Scotland.
Oh, very much so, yes. Our chief worry on that northeast Scottish coast was what's called the Haar, which is a sea mist, a fret. And you can take off on a perfectly fine morning and start doing your exercise. And you might perhaps be a little way from Montrose Airfield. And when you turn around to come back, to your horror, the airfield has disappeared completely under a blanket of sea mist. Now at Montrose, the ruling was that if the airfield became impossible, then you set course due westwards to Edsel, which was a maintenance unit with a good airfield. And usually the fret would only come in a few miles. It would be most unusual for it to reach as far as Edsel. And so one could land there and wait for the conditions to improve before returning to Montrose.
Were there any accidents during this period when you were doing advanced training?
No, I don't think we had. There was... There were two. The first one was an instructor and a pupil managed to crash the aircraft landing. Now, I don't know why or what happened, but the aircraft almost fell out of the sky as it was about to touch down and just broke up. The instructor and the pupil were only slightly hurt. But I do recall the chief flying instructor and the having the instructor standing to attention beside the wrecked aircraft while he got torn off a strip by the chief flying instructor. The other accident was, well, it wasn't so much an accident as enemy action when a strip of when a Hank 111 dropped out of the cloud while we were doing our wings examination, and I glanced out of the window and saw a Hank 111 coming straight for us across the airfield, and he let go a stick of bombs which came towards us as we dived under the desks, and unfortunately a master was just landing at that moment, and it was in fact hit by one of the bombs. The instructor had not seen the bomb, the Heinkel, and so he got taken out by one of the bombs and killed, which was the first fatality I think we had on that course.
You mentioned obviously the instructor was torn off a strip for the poor landing.
Yeah.
What was the attitude during training towards mistakes by pupils and instructors?
The attitude
from obviously the authority to pupils and instructors, should mistakes have been made?
I'm sorry, I don't quite.
I was just wondering if something occurred, an incident occurred.
Yes.
What would the chief instructor's attitude be towards, say, a pupil? Would it be a mild form of rebuke, or would it be something?
I see. Well, I think unless it was something quite extreme, there would be a court of inquiry. The witnesses would be called, the evidence taken, and a decision taken as to what was the cause of the accident. If it was a mechanical failure, of course, well, that was that. It was then over to the technical people to do their bit on their feed in. As for the pupil and or instructor, generally speaking, if a pupil crashed an aircraft accidentally and the circumstances were such that it could be put down to inexperience, then he would normally be allowed to continue his course. On the other hand, no doubt, although I don't recall any such occurrence, but no doubt if there was gross negligence on the part of the pupil, he would be suitably dealt with, but not necessarily taken off the course. It would probably depend largely upon his instructor's report as to whether he was to be allowed to continue. On the other hand, the instructor was found responsible, then he would receive a reprimand or severe reprimand, but not necessarily taken off flying unless it could be shown that he was totally unsuitable. If he's a good instructor, a good record, then it would be a black mark against him. He might get an endorsement. But there's no such thing as fining people or locking them up. They were merely reprimanded and told to be a damn sight more careful in future and left to get on with the job. And I think that probably did the trick in 99 out of 100 cases. So the course at Montrose then proceeded. We were night flying now. We did have the benefit of being literally right on the coast, almost on the beach, in fact. So didn't have too much difficulty keeping track of one's position. And by now the hours were beginning to mount up. I've got 122 hours flying now. And went on into August, and we now started air firing. When I say air firing, we didn't have any guns, but we did have camera guns, and we would carry out air-to-air exercises against other masters. We do air-to-ground against targets on the ground. And I see I was getting 70-80%.
How was that organised? You mentioned camera guns, but how would you attack a target, or what instruction would you receive to attack a target on the ground?
Yes, well, to start with, the first time one went on an air firing exercise, it would be done with the instructor. And I see flying officer Porteous took me on. Oh no, it was an advanced flying program. Instead of flying officer Porteous, he was my senior instructor. Flight Sergeant Midwinter was my main instructor, and his boss was flying officer Porteous, who went on to become chief test pilot for Oster. And every year he would appear, or every other year he would appear at Farnborough, putting on a magnificent display in the latest Oster aircraft. And he did all sorts of incredible things that were quite legendary.
It sounds from what you've said, a number of your instructors were highly experienced RAF personnel at this point.
Yes, they were, yes.
Had they all been flying for a number of years?
Most of them had, yes. Yes, there were a lot of NCO, experienced senior NCO pilots, who'd been, many of them in fact, had joined the Air Force as apprentices, or boy entrants, as some of them are called. And at any time, they could apply for pilot training if they want. That's what they wanted to do. And they were selected and given a chance to get onto a course. And then they became very important members of the RAF squadrons of the day. Some of them probably had been flying from the early 30s or even before then, and by this time probably were getting a bit long in the tooth for operational flying, but their experience was invaluable, particularly at this stage of advanced flying training schools, where we were being launched onto a fairly high performance aircraft straight from the Tiger Moth, and the experience of these people was instrumental in producing the output of trained pilots.
Sorry, I disturbed you. You were going to explain to me about ground firing?
Yes. So the instructor would climb up into his back seat and off you'd go. We'd been briefed on the air firing area, the air firing ranges, which are Montrose, within the Montrose Basin. It's a big circular waterway just to the southwest of the airfield. There were targets, ground targets were rigged on this area. And the instructor would then show you how to go about it. Again, bearing in mind we had no radio, so it was all done by signals to the ground when the target was clear, when we could make our attack and so on. And air-to-ground firing, one would approach the target at 90 degrees, come up abreast of it, turn in towards the target, commence the dive probably from about 1500 feet, line up on the target, press the gun firing button, which was going to operate the cine camera, and pull out over the target, climb up again, and then come around in the circuit and do another attack. Probably do four or five attacks on each such exercise. Similarly, air-to-air, the usual target was a streamed banner, banner that would be towed by a towing aircraft. Or if there are instructors present in both aircraft, attacks would be carried out in turn on the other master, but this was all very much under the control of the instructors.
Was that due to the restrictions?
Well, at this stage, yes, at this stage. I see I did an air-to-air exercise solo in the middle of August, so that we're getting well into the course now, and we've only just started air-to-air firing, but this was solo. We would have done it dual earlier on, no doubt.
What kind of percentage of hits were you getting with your attacks?
Well, I got, on the first air-to-air solo exercise, I got 50% and 70%. That's air-to-air. On the air-to-ground, two attacks, 80% on each one. Next one was 70%. Next one was 70%. So, the right side of 50%.
Was there any particular problems you found in getting lined up on the target getting hits on it?
No, there was no problem getting lined up or attacking it. That's it. That came fairly easily, I found. But when you come to look at the results, they weren't quite what you expected, necessarily. This is particularly true later on, when we were flying operation aircraft, Hurricanes. And we were doing live firing against air-towed banners, and these would be dropped on the airfield for the assessment to be made, and they simply count the number of holes in the banner and work out what sort of success you'd had. I must say that there were never as many holes in the banner as I thought there would be. It seems that when you were firing at the thing, you were riddling it all the time, but in point of fact, when it came down to it, it was nothing like as successful as one had expected.
When you've done the advanced training, obviously at this stage with the firing, the playing with the camera gun, would you watch the footage after you'd done the firing?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that we were shown it afterwards. I'm a little bit confused between whether I saw camera film. Now, whether it was from the Hurricane days or earlier still from the Master days, I'm not sure. But I think there's a way to see them all right.
And you also mentioned at that stage you did formation flying, or the first formation flying.
Ah, yes. Well, that was a very important part, of course, of the course. Formation flying started beginning of August, July, middle of July, formation flying.
Why was it so important?
Well, because as an operational squadron had to have cohesion, and people needed to know where they were supposed to be when the squadron was put up on a scramble, and people had to know exactly where their position was going to be in the formation, and you had to jolly well be quick and get there so that the squadron would climb up and make an interception.
What formations would you fly in when you were doing the training?
Well, nearly always, in fact always, be what we call VICs, a V, three aeroplanes and a V. To begin with, it would just be one two aircraft formating. You take it in turns formating on each other. Now, to the regret of many, many people during the Battle of Britain, the Air Ministry required that fighter squadrons should fly in prescribed formations, which were VICs of three aircraft, flying either in a big Vic of three, i.e. 12 aircraft, 9 aircraft. So you had a lead flight of three, you had another flight of three out on the left-hand side, another flight of three on the right-hand side. Or you might even have a box in which the fourth flight, fourth formation three would come up behind the leader. So you've got a box of four, or a diamond of four, 12 aircraft. Now, this is all very well for Hendon air displays and the like. And indeed, it needed to be neat and tidy. And a formation made up in such a way needed precision. For each aircraft had to be evenly spaced. And for air displays, of course, this was all very splendid. For operational purposes, however, we soon learned that it wasn't a very good idea to fly in these Vics of three, because if you can imagine a single Vic of three aircraft, one of which is the leader, call him Red One. On the port side, you have Red Two. Now, Red Two is looking at the leader, therefore he's looking to the right, he's not looking to the left. On the other side is Red Three, doing the reverse. He's looking to the left, formating on his leader. He's not looking to the right. Which means to say that there's only one person in the three, in the formation of three, who's watching the whole sky. And we soon learned that this was not good, and representations were made to the Air Ministry. But they were quite adamant and insisted on this type of formation being flown, God knows why. Certainly it meant that a squadron could be manoeuvred quite quickly around the sky by the ground controllers. But it meant that the formation was very, very vulnerable and susceptible to attack by enemy fighters, which happened many, many a time. Now, some squadron commanders were bold enough to disregard the rules, and they followed the German-type formations, which was much more fluid, and it did enable everybody in the formation to watch the sky. But it wasn't until well into 41 that things were eased, and the battle formation, as it became known, was adopted by most squadrons.
How aware of this controversy, in a sense, were you aware of during your advanced training?
No, not at all. No, we just accepted that this was it. This is how you flow formation. We'd all seen this formation flying going on at Hendon in the air displays. So it was not unexpected that this is what we did. And of course, it wasn't until we got onto operations that the shortcoming of this close formation flying became apparent.